decided to turn vegetarian. She lost so much weight it was quite shocking to look at her, and she practically stopped sleeping altogether. Yes, she'd always been quiet, but at that time she would say so little that any kind of meaningful communication was impossible. The whole family had been extremely concerned, their parents in particular. All this had happened shortly after Inhye and her husband had moved with Jiwoo to a new apartment. At the housewarming, when the whole family had got together, their father had struck Younghye in the face, held her mouth open and forced a lump of meat inside. Inhye's body had jerked violently, as though she herself were the one receiving the blow. She'd stood and watched, stiff as a ramrod, while Younghye howled like an animal and spat out the meat, then picked up the fruit knife and slit her own wrist. Wasn't there something she could have done to prevent it? Again and again, doubts raced through her mind. Was there really nothing she could have done to stop their father's hand that day, or to get the knife out of Younghye's hand before she had time to hurt herself? Couldn't she have prevented her husband from being the one to pick up the bleeding Younghye and rush her to hospital? And then, once Younghye had been admitted to the psychiatric hospital, surely she could have dissuaded her husband, Mr. Chung, from coldly casting her aside. Above all, that terrible thing that her own husband had done to Younghye, that thing she wanted to put as far from her mind as possible, couldn't she have talked him out of it, found a way to make him change his mind before the whole thing descended into a cheap, tawdry scandal? The lives of all the people around her had tumbled down like a house of cards. Was there really nothing else she could have done? Of course, there'd been no way for her to guess what ideas her casual mention of that small blue Mongolian mark would spark in her husband. But shouldn't she have been able to at least make a guess as to the way things were heading? Hadn't his recent behavior given her sufficient clues? Could she have found a way to impress on him that Younghye was still on medication, was still ill? The only thing clear to her was that what her husband had done was unforgivable. It wasn't until past noon that first her husband and then Younghye had awakened, followed quickly by the three paramedics rushing into the flat, concealing straitjackets and protective equipment. Two of them had immediately gone over to Younghye, who had been leaning precariously out over the veranda railing. She resisted violently as they tried to slip the straitjacket on over her naked, painted, mottled body, biting their arms savagely and letting out an incomprehensible roar. Despite her struggles, they managed to insert an IV needle into her forearm. While all this was going on, her husband had tried to get around the other paramedic, who was standing by the front door, but the man easily caught hold of him. Using all his strength to tear himself free, he whipped around and, without a moment's pause, ran out onto the veranda. He tried to throw himself over the railing. The quick-footed paramedic got hold of him, around the waist, just in time, and after that, he didn't struggle anymore. She had stood there, trembling from head to foot, as she watched all this unfold. Eventually, when her husband was being dragged away and their eyes met, she stared at him as hard as she could. But what she saw in his eyes was neither lust nor insanity, regret nor resentment. There was nothing there except the same terror she herself was feeling. And that was how it all ended, that afternoon, which marked the point after which their lives could never go back to the way they'd been before. Her husband had been held in a police cell after the hospital confirmed that he wasn't mentally ill. It took several months of tedious lawsuits and official inquiries before he was released, after which he went immediately into hiding. She never saw him again. But Younghye's condition was such that she had to remain in the closed ward. After her initial bout of mental illness, she'd returned to the stage where she was able to speak to others, only to now withdraw into silence once more. But it wasn't simply that she didn't engage in conversation. Back in the closed ward, she'd taken to squatting down in a sunny spot where she wouldn't be disturbed and muttering incessantly to herself. As before, she refused to eat meat, and if she so much as set eyes on a side dish containing meat, she would scream and try to run away. On sunny days, she would press herself up against the window, unbutton her hospital gown, and bare her breasts to the sun. Their parents, whom the whole sorry saga seemed to have greatly aged, didn't make any further effort to visit Younghye, and even severed contact with their elder daughter, Inhye, who reminded them of the despicable way they treated Younghye. The two sisters' younger brother, Young-ho, and his wife were no different. But she, In-hye, could not bring herself to abandon Young-hye. Someone had to pay the hospital fees. Someone had to act as her carer. And she got by, as she always had done. Despite the scandal hanging over her, steadfastly refusing to disappear, she made sure that the shop kept running. Time was a wave, almost cruel in its relentlessness, as it whisked her life downstream, a life she had to constantly strain to keep from breaking apart. Ji-woo, who had been 5 that autumn, was now 6, and Young-hye, who had been transferred to a hospital where the environment was good and the fees were reasonable, looked to have greatly improved. Even as a child, In-hye had possessed the innate strength of character necessary to make one's own way in life. As a daughter, as an older sister, as a wife and as a mother, as the owner of a shop, even as an underground passenger on the briefest of journeys, she had always done her best. Through the sheer inertia of a life lived in this way, she would have been able to conquer everything, even time. If only Young-hye hadn't suddenly disappeared last March. If only she hadn't been discovered in the forest that rainy night. If only all of her symptoms hadn't suddenly got worse. Preceded by the sound of quick, purposeful footsteps, a young doctor wearing a white gown approaches from the other end of the corridor. He sketches a shallow bow when In-hye stands up to greet him, gesturing toward the consulting room with an expansive sweep of his arm. She follows him inside. The doctor, who is in his late 30s, has a healthy, robust physique. The set of his jaw and his manner of walking speak of a certain self-confidence. He sits behind the desk and stares over it at her, his brow furrowed. Sensing that the tone of the discussion will not be positive, she feels her heart become heavy. "My sister. We've done our very best, but her condition hasn't improved. In that case, today..." She blushes, as if having committed some embarrassing blunder. The doctor doesn't wait for her to continue. "Today we'll try feeding her intravenously, and if we're lucky her condition might improve just a little. Otherwise, there'll be nothing else for it but to transfer her to one of the critical wards at the general hospital." "Before that, would it be all right for me to try to talk to her? To make her see sense?" she asks. His eyes show that he holds no great hopes for her attempts at persuasion. He seems worn out, trying to conceal the anger he feels toward those patients who fail to live up to his expectations. He glances at his watch. "I'll give you around 30 minutes. If you're successful, please let them know in the nurse's room. Otherwise, I'll see you at 2. She expects him to get up immediately and sweep out of the room, but instead he chooses to drag the conversation out a little longer, perhaps mindful of having been a little abrupt. "I know I told you this last time, but 15 to 20% of anorexia nervosa patients will starve to death. Even when they're down to nothing but skin and bone, the subject is still convinced that they've put on weight. There can be all manner of psychological factors at play. A power struggle with a domineering mother, for example. But Kim Young-hye's is one of those particular cases where the subject refuses to eat while suffering from schizophrenia. We were confident that her schizophrenia wasn't serious. There was honestly no way for us to predict that things would turn out the way they have. In cases where the subject is paranoid about being poisoned, they can usually be reasoned with, or else the doctor can eat the food in front of them. Let them see that it's fine. But we're still not sure exactly why it is that Kim Young-hye is refusing to eat, and none of the medicines we've given her seem to have had any effect. It wasn't an easy decision for us to make, but there's no other way. Our first duty as doctors is to preserve life, and we simply can't be sure of keeping her alive here." The doctor makes as if to stand up, then hesitates. "Your complexion doesn't look healthy. Are you not sleeping well?" His question seems motivated by a professional habit, and she cannot think of a quick answer. "Carers have to look after their own health too, you know." They exchange bows. Then the doctor opens the door and strides away. By the time she leaves the room, his retreating figure is already disappearing down the corridor. When she returns to the long bench in front of the reception desk, a flashily dressed middle-aged woman is just coming in through the front door, on the arm of a similarly aged man. Have they come to visit a patient? The next instant, an unbroken stream of invective starts pouring forth from the woman's mouth. Seemingly well accustomed to her cursing, the man pays no attention as he gets the medical insurance certificate out of his wallet and slides it under the window at the reception desk. Wicked little shits! You won't be satisfied even when you've sucked my insides dry! I'm going to emigrate! I can't spend another day with shits like you! If the process of admittance is completed in time, the woman will probably end up spending the night in the secure room. More than likely, her limbs will be bound and a tranquilizer will be administered. Inye stares at the garish flower-patterned hat worn by this shrieking woman. All of a sudden, she realizes how blasé she's become when it comes to the mentally ill. In fact, after all these visits to the hospital, sometimes it's the tranquil streets filled with so-called normal people that end up seeming strange. She remembers the day she first brought Youngye here, a bright afternoon in early winter. The closed ward of Seoul General Hospital was actually quite near her house, but the admittance fee was more than she could scrape together, so she'd asked around a bit before settling on this hospital where the treatment was apparently quite good. It was when she'd met with the doctor at the other hospital who wanted Youngye to be discharged that she'd been advised to consider outpatient care. So far, the results that we've observed directly have been good. She probably isn't in a position yet to return to any kind of social life, but the support of her family will be a great help. "That's what I was told last time, too," she told him. "I believed it and had Youngye discharged, but now it seems like that was the wrong thing to do." Though the ostensible reason for her not wanting Youngye to be discharged, the reason that she gave the doctor, was this worry about a possible relapse, now she was able to admit to herself what had really been going on. She was no longer able to cope with all that her sister reminded her of. She'd been unable to forgive her for soaring alone over a boundary she herself could never bring herself to cross. Unable to forgive that magnificent irresponsibility that had enabled Youngye to shuck off social constraints and leave her behind, still a prisoner. And before Youngye had broken those bars, she'd never even known they were there. Luckily, Youngye was in favor of being admitted. Dressed in everyday clothes and telling the doctor in a distinct voice that she was comfortable there in the hospital, she had seemed calm. The look in her eyes was clear, and the set of her mouth was firm. It was almost impossible to tell her apart from ordinary people, aside, of course, from the fact that, skinny to begin with, she was at that point alarmingly thin. In the taxi on the way there, she gazed quietly out of the window, showing not even the slightest hint of unease. And when they sent the taxi away, she'd obediently followed her sister as though they'd simply come out for a stroll. She'd looked so normal that the receptionist had actually had to ask which one of them was the patient. While they waited for Younghae's documents to be processed, Inye said to her sister, "The air is good here. It'll give you more of an appetite. You'll be able to eat a bit more and put on some weight." Younghae, who at the time was just beginning to speak again, cast her gaze toward the zelkova tree on the other side of the window and said, "Yes, there are big trees here." Having been called down by the receptionist, a strong-looking middle-aged nurse came and checked through their hospital bag. Underclothes, everyday clothes, slippers, toiletries. He spread the clothes out carefully, going through them one by one, seemingly to check that there weren't any strings or pins. He removed the long, thick woolen belt from the coat Inye had packed and asked the two of them to follow him. The nurse unlocked the door to the six-person ward and led them in. Youngye remained composed as her sister greeted each of the nurses in turn. Eventually, she set the hospital bag down and went over to the window, which had a heavy-looking set of bars running vertically across it. Just then, she was discomfited to find herself struck by a guilty conscience, which she'd so far managed to avoid. Suddenly, it was there, like a lump in her chest, weighing her down. Youngye walked up soundlessly and stood beside her.
"Ah, you can see the trees from here, too."
"You will not be weak," Inye told herself, her lips pressed tightly together. "At any rate, she is a burden you cannot bear. No one blames you. You've done well to make it this far." She didn't look at Yonghae as she stood beside her. Instead, she looked down at the bright early winter sunlight as it splintered over the larches, which had not yet shed all their leaves.
Sister,
Yonghae said, her voice low and calm as if intending to comfort her. Yonghae's old black sweater gave off the faint scent of mothballs. When Inhye didn't answer, Yonghae whispered one more time,
Sister, all the trees of the world are like brothers and sisters.
She walks past the second annex and stops in front of the door to the first annex. She sees the patients pressing themselves against the glass door and peering outside. They're probably feeling a bit claustrophobic, the rain having kept them cooped up inside for the past few days. When Inhye presses the bell, a nurse in his late 30s comes out from the nurse's room by the ground floor lobby carrying a key. The nurse closes the door quickly behind him, inserts the key and locks it. Inhye notices a young female patient staring out at her, her cheek pressed against the inside of the locked glass door. Her two empty eyes scrutinize Inhye as though trying to bore through her skin. There is no way she could look at a stranger like that if her mind were sound.
How is my sister at the moment?
She asks as they climb the stairs to the third floor. The nurse looks back over his shoulder and shakes his head. She's stopped talking. She's also been trying to pull the IV needle out, so we had to get her into the secure room and give her a tranquilizer before we could put it back in. How she has the strength to shake us off.
So she's in the secure room now?
No. She woke up a little while ago, so we moved her back to the ward. They told you they're putting the nasal drip in at 2, right? She follows the nurse into the third floor lobby. On fine days, there are elderly patients sitting on the long bench by the window and soaking up the sun, others engrossed in a game of table tennis, cheery music filtering in from the nurse's room. But today, all of that liveliness seems to have been smothered by the incessant rain. Perhaps because the majority of the patients are in their wards, there isn't much going on in the lobby. The table tennis bats lie unused on the table. She looks down along the ward's western corridor where, right at the end, the afternoon sunlight shines through the large window more brightly than in any other spot on sunny days. When Inhye came to see Yonghae last March, just a few days before the latter disappeared into the rainy woods, Yonghae refused to come to the visiting room. When Inhye contacted the head nurse from reception, the nurse said that, oddly enough, Yonghae hadn't wanted to leave the ward for several days now. Even during the hour when an unaccompanied walk was permitted, a time that all the patients always looked forward to, she kept to the ward. When Inhye asked if she could just go and look at her sister's face, given that she'd come all this way, the nurse came down to reception to accompany her. When she came upon the unexpected sight of a female patient doing a handstand at the far end of the western corridor, it never even crossed her mind that it might be Yonghae. Only when the nurse with whom she'd just spoken on the telephone guided her in that direction had she been able to recognize Yonghae's long, thick hair. Her sister was upside down and balancing on her hands, her face flushed, almost puce.
She's been at it for 30 minutes already, the nurse said, seeming impatient. It started 2 days ago. It's not that she isn't aware of her surroundings or that she doesn't speak. She's different from the other catatonic patients. Up until yesterday, we'd been having to force her back into the ward, but no matter what we did, she just started up the handstands again as soon as she was in the ward, so we can't even force her to stop.
Before he went back to the nurse's room, the nurse said, "She'll fall over if you give her a little nudge. Give it a try if you can't get her to talk to you. We would have to push her over to get her back in the ward anyway." Left alone with Yonghae, Inhye squatted down and tried to look her sister in the eye. Anyone's face will look different when they're upside down. Yonghae's face certainly looked odd, with what little flesh he had on her cheeks pushed down toward her eyes. Those eyes were glittering and sharp as Yonghae stared into space. She seemed unaware of her sister's presence.
Yonghae!
No reply.
Yonghae! What are you doing? Stand up!
She reached out a hand to Yonghae's flushed cheek.
Stand up, Yonghae. Doesn't your head hurt? For goodness sake, your face is bright red.
With nothing else for it, she gave her sister a gentle push. Just as the nurse had said, Younghae immediately tumbled to the floor, and Inhae quickly lifted her head up, supporting her neck as you would with a baby.
Sister!
Younghae's face was wreathed in smiles, her eyes shining, as though she'd just woken up from a happy dream.
When did you get here?
The nurse, who'd been watching the two of them, came up and led them to the meeting room that adjoined the lobby. This, she explained, was where family members could meet with the patients whose symptoms were so severe that it was difficult for them to go down to the visiting room in reception. Inhae guessed that it was also where consultations with the doctor took place. When Inhae laid the food she'd brought out on the table, Younghae said,
Sister, you don't have to bring that stuff now.
She smiled.
I don't need to eat anymore.
What are you talking about?
Inhae stared at her sister as though she were possessed. It was a long time since she'd seen Younghae's face shining like this. No, in fact, it was the first time.
What on earth were you doing just now?
She asked. Younghae met her question with another.
Sister, did you know?
Know what?
I didn't, you see. I thought trees stood up straight. I only found out just now. They actually stand with both arms in the earth. All of them. Look, look over there. Aren't you surprised?
Younghae sprang up and pointed to the window.
All of them. They're all standing on their heads.
Younghae laughed frantically. Inhae remembered moments from their childhood when Younghae's face had worn the same expression as it did now. Those moments when her sister's single-lidded eyes would narrow and turn completely dark, when that innocent laughter would come rushing out of her mouth.
Do you know how I found out? Well, I was in a dream, and I was standing on my head. Leaves were growing from my body, and roots were sprouting from my hands. So I dug down into the earth, on and on. I wanted flowers to bloom from my crotch, so I spread my legs. I spread them wide.
Bewildered, Inhae looked across at Younghae's feverish eyes.
I need to water my body. I don't need this kind of food, sister. I need water.
Thank you so much for all your trouble, Inhae tells the head nurse. I really appreciate it.
She holds out the rice cakes she's brought and greets the other nurses in turn. While she makes her usual inquiries regarding Younghae's condition, a female patient in her 50s who has mistaken her for a nurse hurries over from the window and gives her a shallow bow.
My head hurts. Please tell the doctor to change my medication.
I'm not a nurse. I'm here to see my sister.
The woman stares deep into Inhae's eyes.
Please help me. My head hurts so much I can't go on. How can I live like this?
Just then, a male patient in his 20s comes and presses himself against Inhae's back. It's a common enough occurrence in the hospital, but it makes her nervous all the same. The patients pay no mind to conventional ideas about personal space, or it being rude to stare at other people. On the one hand, there are many of them whose utterly blank gazes indicate minds shut up in their own private worlds. But then again, there are also a certain number who appear so lucid, one could easily mistake them for members of the medical staff. Younghae had been one of the latter kind, once.
Nurse, why on earth doesn't anyone ever do anything about that guy?
A familiar female patient in her 30s shouts at the head nurse, her tone aggressive.
I mean, you know perfectly well how he's always hitting me.
The woman's persecution mania seems to get worse every time Inhae visits. Inhae bows to the nurses again.
I'll just go and have a talk with my sister.
Judging by the nurses' expressions, they are all well and truly fed up with Younghae. Clearly, none of them is holding out any hope that Inhae's attempts at persuasion will have the slightest effect. She threads her way out carefully between the patients, taking care not to brush against them. She walks down the eastern corridor outside Younghae's ward. The door to the ward is open, and when she enters, a woman with her hair cropped short comes up to her.
Ah, you're visiting today?
The woman is Hee-joo, who is receiving treatment for alcoholism and hypomania. Her body is stout, but her round eyes give her a sweet look, and her voice is always somewhat hoarse. In this hospital, the patients who are in good control of their faculties look after those with more acute psychological problems and receive a little pocket money in return. When Young-hae had grown difficult to manage, refusing point-blank to eat, she had come under the care of Hee-ju.
"Thanks for all your trouble," In-hye says, and is about to force out a laugh when Hee-ju's slightly damp hand clasps her own.
"What can we do?"
Hee-ju says, her round eyes filling with tears.
"They're saying Young-hae might die."
"How has she been?"
"Just now, she vomited some blood. She doesn't eat, so her stomach acid is eating away at her stomach, and she constantly has these convulsions. And now this bleeding, too?"
Hee-ju grows ever closer to the brink of tears.
"When I first began to look after her, she wasn't like this. Perhaps she might have been okay if I'd taken better care of her. Do you think? I didn't know she would end up like this. Perhaps this wouldn't be happening to her if I hadn't been put in charge of her."
Hee-ju is working herself up, so In-hye releases her hand and slowly approaches the bed. If only one's eyes weren't visible to others, she thinks. If only one could hide one's eyes from the world. Young-hye is lying very straight on the bed. At first, she looks as though she is gazing out of the window. But on closer inspection, she actually isn't looking at anything at all. Barely any flesh remains on her face, neck, shoulders, and limbs. In-hye notices the hair growing on her sister's cheeks and forearms, fine but unusually long, like the faint down that babies often have. The doctor had explained that this was due to Young-hye's hormonal balance being disturbed, something that happens after a long period of starvation. Is Young-hye trying to turn herself back into a pre-adolescent? She hasn't had her period for a long time now, and now that her weight has dropped below 30 kilos, of course there's nothing left of her breasts. She lies there looking like a freakish, overgrown child, devoid of any secondary sexual characteristics. In-hye lifts up the white bedsheet. She turns the completely unresisting Young-hye over and checks that no bed sores have appeared on her coccyx or back. The area that had been inflamed last time still hasn't got any better. In-hye allows her gaze to rest on the clear, pale, blue Mongolian mark imprinted in the middle of her buttocks, which are now wasted away to the bone. The image of those flowers which had spread out from that mark like bleeding ink, covering Young-hye's whole body, flickers briefly, dizzyingly, in front of In-hye's eyes.
"Thank you for everything, Hee-ju.
Every day I wash her with a wet towel and powder her skin, too. It's this damp weather that won't let it heal."
"Thank you so much."
"I used to need one of the nurses to help me give her a bath. Now she's so light, I can lift her easily on my own. It really is like caring for a baby. Anyway, I was hoping to give her a bath today as well. I heard you're moving her to a different hospital, so this would be the last time."
Hee-ju's big eyes turn red again.
"All right, let's give her a bath together in a little while."
"Yes, the hot water comes on at 4.
Hee-ju wipes her bloodshot eyes one after the other.
"All right, then I'll see you in a bit."
In-hye nods to Hee-ju as the latter leaves, then covers Young-hye back up with a sheet, adjusting it to make sure that her sister's feet aren't sticking out. In-hye checks for burst veins and finds them everywhere, on both hands, the soles of both feet, even her elbows. The only means of providing Young-hye with proteins and glucose is the IV, but now there are no undamaged veins left where a needle could be put in. The only other way would be to link the IV to one of the arteries that run over Young-hye's shoulders. Yesterday, the doctor phoned In-hye to explain that, as this requires a dangerous surgical operation, Young-hye would have to be transferred to the general hospital. They tried on numerous occasions to get some gruel into Young-hye by inserting a long tube into her nose, but this had always ended in failure, as Young-hye had simply closed up her gullet. They would try this method one last time today, but if this too failed, then Young-hye would no longer be able to remain in their care. 3 months ago, just after Young-hye had been found in the forest, When Inye had arrived at reception on the scheduled visiting day, she'd been told that Younghae's doctor wanted to meet with her. This made her anxious, as she hadn't spoken with him since Younghae had first been admitted. "We know that it disturbs her psychologically if she sees a side dish containing meat, so we've been taking extra care to make sure this doesn't happen. But now she won't even come down to the lobby at mealtimes, and even if we bring a meal tray up to the ward, she won't eat. It's already been 4 days. She started to become dehydrated. And since she becomes violent every time we try to put in a drip, well, I'm not sure we can even give her the medicine properly anymore." In fact, the doctor doubted whether Younghae had been taking her medication at all. He even blamed himself for not being as vigilant as he should have been, after things had initially seemed to be going well. Just that morning, the nurse had been asked to check that Younghae had took her medicine, but apparently, Younghae hadn't listened when she'd been told to stick out her tongue. When the nurse then forced her tongue up and used a flashlight to look inside, the tablets were still there. That day back then, as Younghae lay there in the ward with the drip needle inserted into the back of her hand, Inye asked her, "Why did you do it? What were you doing in those dark woods? Wasn't it cold? What would you have done if you'd caught something, something serious?" Younghae's face was terribly haggard, and her uncombed hair was matted like seaweed. "You have to eat. I understand you not eating meat if you don't like it, but why won't you eat other things now either?" Younghae's lips twitched almost imperceptibly. "I'm thirsty," she whispered. "Give me some water." Inye went and fetched some from the lobby. After she'd had a drink, Younghae let out a shallow sigh and asked, "Did you talk to the doctor, sister?" "Yes, I did." "Why?" Younghae cut her off. "They say my insides have all atrophied, you know." Inye was lost for words. Younghae moved her emaciated face closer to her sister. "I'm not an animal anymore, sister," she said, first scanning the empty ward as if about to disclose a momentous secret. "I don't need to eat. Not now. I can live without it. All I need is sunlight." "What are you talking about? Do you really think you've turned into a tree? How could a plant talk? How can you think these things?" Younghae's eyes shone. A mysterious smile played on her face. "You're right. Soon now, words and thoughts will all disappear. Soon." Younghae burst into laughter, then sighed. "Very soon. Just a bit longer to wait, sister."
Time passes. Outside the window, the rain looks to be coming down less heavily than before. The raindrops on the mosquito netting appear undisturbed, so perhaps the rain actually stopped a little while ago. Inye sits down in a chair by Younghae's bedside, opens her bag, and gets out various containers of different sizes, all tightly sealed. She opens the lid of the smallest container first. A sweet fragrance spreads through the humid air of the ward.
"It's a peach, Younghae. A tinned Huangdo peach. You like them, remember? You used to insist on buying them even when fresh peaches were in season, just like a child."
She carves off a piece of the ripe, yielding fruit with a fork and brings it up to Younghae's nose.
"Smell that. Don't you want to try a bit?"
The next container is filled with watermelon, cut up into conveniently sized cubes.
"Don't you remember? When you were young, every time I cut a watermelon in half, you would come and smell it. With some of them, when we cut them up, they gave off this wonderful sweet smell that spread through the whole house."
Younghae remains entirely motionless. Inye gently rubs a piece of melon against her sister's lips. She tries to use two of her fingers to part Younghae's lips, but her mouth is shut tight.
"Younghae," Inye says. Her voice is low. "Answer me, Younghae."
She shakes her sister by her stiff shoulders and resists the temptation to force her mouth open. She wants to yell right into her sister's ear. "What are you doing? Are you listening to me? Do you want to die? Do you really want to die?
Dazed, she examines the hot anger that is boiling up inside her like spume.
Time passes. Inhye turns her head and looks out the window. The rain seems finally to have stopped, but the sky is still overcast, the wet trees still silent. The densely wooded slopes of Mount Chuksong stretch far into the distance. The huge forest blanketing those slopes is as silent as everything else. She gets a thermos flask out of her bag and pours Chinese quince tea into the stainless steel cup.
Try some, Yonghe. It's infused really well.
She brings it to her own lips first and takes a sip. The taste that lingers on the tip of her tongue is sweet and fragrant. After pouring some of the tea onto a hand towel, she uses it to moisten Yonghe's lips. There is no response.
Are you trying to die?
She asks.
You're not, are you? If all you want to do is become a tree, you still have to eat. You have to live.
She stops speaking. Her breath catches in her throat. A suspicion that she hasn't wanted to acknowledge has finally raised its head. Might she have been mistaken?
Might it be precisely that, death, which Yonghe is after, which she has been after from the first?
No, she repeats silently. You're not trying to die.
Before Yonghe stopped speaking for good, around a month ago, she had said,
Sister, please let me out of here.
She would often break off mid-sentence, perhaps because she found it difficult to keep talking for a long time, and her speech was mingled with the rasping sound of her breathing.
People are always telling me to eat. I don't like eating. They force me. Last time I threw it up. Yesterday, as soon as I'd eaten, they gave me an injection to put me to sleep. Sister, I don't like injections. I really don't like them. Please let me out. I don't like being here.
Inye had held Yonghe's wasted hand and said,
But you can't even walk properly anymore. It's only now that you've got this IV that you're managing to keep going. If you come home, will you eat? If you promise to eat, I'll get you discharged.
She couldn't fail to notice how the light went out of Yonghe's eyes then.
Yonghe, answer me. All you need to do is promise.
Yonghe twisted away from her sister.
You're just the same,
she whispered, her voice barely audible.
What are you talking about? No one can understand me. The doctors, the nurses, they're all the same. They don't even try to understand. They just force me to take medication and stab me with needles.
Yonghe's voice was slow and quiet but firm. Inhye couldn't hold herself back any longer.
You, she yelled. I'm acting like this because I'm afraid you're going to die.
Yonghe turned her head and stared blankly at Inhye, as though the latter were not her sister, but a complete stranger. After a while, the question came.
Why is it such a bad thing to die?
Why is it such a bad thing to die? A long time ago, she and Yonghe had got lost on a mountain. Yonghe, who had been 9 at the time, said,
Let's just not go back.
At the time, Inhye hadn't understood what she meant.
What are you talking about? It'll get dark any minute now. We have to hurry up and find the path.
Only after all this time was she able to understand why Yonghe had said what she did. Yonghe had been the only victim of their father's beatings. Such violence wouldn't have bothered their brother Youngho so much, a boy who went around doling out his own rough justice to the village children. As the eldest daughter, Inye had been the one who took over from their exhausted mother and made a broth for her father to wash the liquor down, and so he'd always taken a certain care in his dealings with her. Only Yonghe, docile and naive, had been unable to deflect their father's temper or put up any form of resistance. Instead, she had merely absorbed all her suffering inside her, deep into the marrow of her bones. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, Inhye could see that the role that she had adopted back then, of the hard-working, self-sacrificing eldest daughter, had been a sign not of maturity, but of cowardice. It had been a survival tactic. Could I have prevented it? Could I have prevented those unimaginable things from sinking so deep inside of Younghye and holding her in their grip? She saw her sister again as a child, her back and shoulders in the back of her head, as she stood alone in front of the main gate at sunset. The two of them had eventually made it down off the mountain, but on the opposite side from where they'd started. They'd hitched a ride on a power tiller back to their small town, hurrying along the unfamiliar road as darkness fell. Inhye had been relieved, but not her sister. Younghye had said nothing, only stood and watched the flaming poplars kindled by the evening light. Had they run away from home that evening, as Younghye had suggested, would it all have been different? At the family gathering that day, if she'd been more forceful when she grabbed their father's arm before he struck Younghye in the face, would it all have been different then? And what about when she first took Younghye to be introduced to her future husband, Mr. Chung? He'd come across as somewhat cold. She hadn't taken to him at all. What would have happened if she'd acted on instinct and refused to let the marriage go forward? There'd been a time when she could spend hours like this, weighing up all the variables that might have contributed to determining Younghye's fate. Of course, it was entirely in vain, this act of mentally picking up and counting the potluck stones that had been laid out on the board of her sister's life. More than that, it wasn't even possible. But she couldn't stop her thoughts from running on to her ex-husband. If only she hadn't married him. He called her just once. It was around 9 months ago, and close on midnight. Perhaps he'd been calling from somewhere far away, because there was a brief lag after the sound of the coin tumbling.
"I want to see Jiwoo."
His oh-so-familiar voice, low and tense. She could tell he was struggling to sound composed. Was like a blunt knife stabbing her in the chest.
"Couldn't you let me see him? Just one time."
So that was what he'd called to say. Not to say he was sorry. Not to beg for her forgiveness. Only to talk about the child. He didn't even ask whether Younghye was all right. She'd always known how sensitive he was. A man whose self-esteem was so easily wounded, who quickly became frustrated if the situation didn't go his way. She knew that if she refused him this one more time, it would probably be a very long time before he contacted her again. Even though she was aware of this, no, because she was aware of it, she hung up without answering. A public telephone booth in the middle of the night. Worn-out sneakers, shabby clothes. A despairing face. No longer young. She shook her head, trying to erase those images from her mind. Whenever she thought of him now, those thoughts were quietly overlaid with the way he'd looked when he tried to throw himself over the railing of Younghye's veranda, trying to fly like a bird. All those scenes of flight he'd included in his videos. And yet, when he needed it most, such flight had proved beyond him.
"I don't know you," she muttered, tightening her grip on the receiver, which she'd hung back in the cradle but was still clutching. "So there's no need for us to forgive each other, because I don't know you."
When the phone rang again, she pulled out the cord. The next morning she connected it up again, but as she predicted, he didn't call again. Time passes. Now Younghye's eyes are closed. Is she sleeping? Can she smell the fruit her sister put to her lips just now? Inhye looks at Younghye's prominent cheekbones, her hollow eyes, her sunken cheeks. She feels her sister's ragged breath. She gets up and walks over to the window, where the dark gray of the sky is gradually lightening, the landscape growing brighter at the edges. The light touches upon Mount Chuksong's forest, rekindling its summer colors. The place where Younghye was discovered that night must be somewhere over on that slope.
"I heard something," Younghye had said, lying hooked up to the drip. "I went there because I heard something calling me. I don't hear it anymore now. I was just standing there waiting."
When Inhye asked, "What are you waiting for?" a fever came into Younghye's eyes. Her right hand was the one with the needle in it. She reached out with her left and grabbed Inhye's hand. Inhye was shocked by how strong her grip was.
It melted in the rain. It all melted. I'd been just about to go down into the earth. There was nothing else for it if I wanted to turn myself upside down again, you see.
Hiju's excited tone jolts Inhye out of these memories.
What can we do about Yongye? They're saying she might die.
To Inhye, Hiju's words sounded like the deafening roar of a plane taking off. There is one memory that Inhye has never been able to tell anyone else about, and probably never will. April, 2 years ago. The spring of the year when her husband made that video of Yongye. Inhye had bled from her vagina for close on a month, on and off. She'd never been able to understand why, but for some reason, every time she washed her blood-soaked pants, she would recall the way in which the blood from Younghae's wrist had spurted out into the air. Every day she decided she would go for a medical examination the next day. Then, when the next day came, she would postpone it again. She was afraid of going to the hospital. If it was a serious disease, how much time might she have left? A year? 6 months? Or 3 months? For the first time, she became vividly aware of how much of her life she had spent with her husband. It had been a period of time utterly devoid of happiness and spontaneity, a time that she'd so far managed to get through only by using up every last reserve of perseverance and consideration, all of it self-inflicted. On the morning when she'd finally mustered the courage to go to the obstetrics and gynecology department, the one where Jiwoo had been born, she'd stood on the open-air platform at Wang Shimni Station and waited for the train, which was taking an unusually long time to arrive. Opposite the platform was a row of temporary buildings, their steel structures now decaying, and wild grasses straggling up between the sleepers on the edges over which no trains passed. The feeling that she had never really lived in this world caught her by surprise. It was a fact. She had never lived. Even as a child, as far back as she could remember, she had done nothing but endure. She had believed in her own inherent goodness, her humanity, and lived accordingly, never causing anyone harm. Her devotion to doing things the right way had been unflagging. All her success had depended on it, and she would have gone on like that indefinitely. She didn't understand why, but faced with those decaying buildings and straggling grasses, she was nothing but a child who had never lived. She'd fought down her feeling of shame and managed to stop trembling before getting up onto the bed. The middle-aged male doctor then pushed a cold abdominal scope deep into her vagina and removed a tongue-like polyp that had been stuck to the vaginal wall. Her body flinched away from the sharp pain. "So this is why you've been bleeding. Well, it came away cleanly, so the bleeding should start to lessen in a few days and then stop altogether. Your ovaries are completely fine. So there's nothing for you to worry about there." There wasn't even a scrap of happiness that she could glean from this. Instead of a serious illness, a possibility that had caused her no end of worry over the past month, it had been nothing but a minor niggle. Back on the platform at Wang Shimni, it wasn't only the pain from the operation that caused her legs to tremble. When the train eventually roared into the platform, she staggered behind one of the metal chairs and hid herself, afraid that something inside her would make her throw herself in front of the solid mass of the train. How to explain the 4 months or so that followed on from that day? The bleeding continued for around another 2 weeks, then the cut healed and it stopped, but she felt as though there was still an open wound inside her body. Somehow, it seemed this wound had in fact grown bigger than her, that her whole body was being pulled into its pitch-black maw. She looked on in silence as spring passed and summer arrived. The outfits sported by her female customers grew progressively shorter and more colorful. As always, she smiled at the customers, never failed to recommend additional products or give discounts where appropriate, and made sure to pack up a complimentary sample with every purchase. She put up posters advertising new products in carefully chosen locations around the shop, where they would catch the customers' eyes, and handled with ease those occasions when skincare consultants hadn't got good feedback and therefore had to be replaced. But in the evenings when she left her employees and walked through the sweltering night streets, brimming with music and crowded with couples on dates, she could feel that gaping black wound still sucking at her, pulling her in. She dragged her sweat-soaked body through the street and away from the crowds. It happened around the time when those sweltering summer days had started to cool down a little, at least in the mornings and evenings. When he arrived back at the house early one morning, sneaking in like a thief after several days away, got into bed, and tried to put his arms around her, she pushed him away.
"I'm tired. I said I'm really tired."
"Just put up with it for a minute," he said. She remembered how it had been. Those words had run through her semi-conscious mind again and again. Still half asleep, she'd managed to get through it by thinking to herself that it was all right. It would just be this one time. It would be over soon. She could put up with it. The pain and shame had been washed away by the deep, exhausted sleep she slipped into immediately afterward. And yet later, at the breakfast table, she would all of a sudden find herself wanting to stab herself in the eyes with her chopsticks, or pour the boiling water from the kettle over her head. Once her husband had fallen asleep, the bedroom was still and silent again. She picked up Jiwoo, who had been sleeping on his side, and put him back down so that he was lying on his back, seeing as she did so how pitiful they must appear, mother and child faintly outlined in the darkness. There was nothing the matter. It was a fact. Everything would be fine as long as she just kept going, just carried on with her life as she always had done. In any case, there was no other way. She left the bedroom and looked out the dark blue veranda window. The toys that Jiwoo had been playing with last night, the sofa and the television, the black door flaps underneath the sink, and the splotches of grease on the gas range. It was as though she were seeing these things for the first time, walking around the house as though she'd never been there before. A strange pain gripped her chest. It was an oppressive, constricting feeling, as if the walls of the house were slowly closing in. She opened the wardrobe door and took out the purple cotton t-shirt. Its color had faded, because Jiwoo had liked it when he was nursing and so she'd worn it often in the house. It was the kind of thing she liked to wear when she was ill or just not feeling her best. Even though she'd washed it countless times, that milk and newborn baby smell still gave her a sense of security. But this time it didn't work. The pain in her chest got worse. Her breathing grew shallow, and she had to make an effort to try to breathe more deeply. She sat down on the sofa. Her eyes followed the second hand on the clock as it ticked around, and she made another effort to regulate her breathing. To her surprise, there was still no improvement. A feeling of déjà vu crept up on her then, a feeling of having already experienced this same moment countless times. The proof of her internal pain had been set in front of her as though this were something she spent a long time preparing for, as though she'd been waiting for just this moment. "All of this is meaningless. I can't take it anymore. I can't go on any longer. I don't want to." She took one more look around at the various objects inside the house. They did not belong to her, just like her life had never belonged to her. Her life was no more than a ghostly pageant of exhausted endurance, no more real than a television drama. Death, who now stood by her side, was as familiar to her as a family member, missing for a long time, but now returned. She got up, shivering, and went over to the room where the toys had been left scattered. Every evening for the past week, she would take down the mobile which Jiwoo had helped her to decorate and began to untie the thick cord. It was wound so tightly that it hurt the tips of her fingers, but she continued patiently until the final knot was untied. She rolled up the colored paper and cellophane, which had been decorated with stars, and tidied it away in a basket, then rolled up the cord and put it in her trouser pocket. She slipped on a pair of sandals, pushed open the heavy front door, and went out. She walked down the 5 flights of stairs. It was still dark outside. The huge apartment building was illuminated only by the light she herself had left on. She carried on walking, through the gate at the rear of the apartment complex, and up the dark, narrow path to the mountain. The folds of the mountain looked deeper than usual in the blue-black darkness. It was so early that even the old-timers who diligently went out to collect mineral water at dawn were still asleep in their beds. She walked on, head bowed. There was something on her face, sweat or tears, she wasn't sure, and she wiped it away with the back of her hand. The pain feels like a hole swallowing her up, a source of intense fear, and yet, at the same time, a strange, quiet peace. Time passes. Inhye sits back down. She opens the lid of the last container. She takes hold of Younghye's stiff hand and pulls it toward the plums, running her sister's fingers over their smooth skin. She curls those gaunt fingers around one of the plums, makes her hold it. Plums are one of the fruits that Younghye used to like. Inhye remembered that, as a child, Younghye would sometimes roll one around inside her mouth for a while without biting into it, saying that she liked the way it felt. But now her sister's hand is limp and unresponsive. Her fingernails have become as thin as paper.
Younghye!
Her voice sounds dry and rasping in the silence of the ward. No answer. She brings her face up close to Younghye's. Just then, though it seems unbelievable, Younghye's eyelids flutter open.
Younghye!
She peers into her sister's empty black pupils, but all that she sees reflected there is her own face. The strength of her own disappointment takes her by surprise, plunging her into despair.
You're actually insane.
It's a thought she hasn't been able to countenance these past few days, but now, for the first time, she asks Younghye the question,
Have you really lost your mind?
An inscrutable fear makes her draw back from her sister, but she remains seated. The stillness of the ward, without even the sound of breathing to break the silence, is like waterlogged cotton wool stopping up her ears.
Perhaps, she mutters to herself, perhaps it's simpler than I thought.
She hesitates, falling silent for a while.
You're crazy, and so...
Instead of completing the thought, she reaches out and touches her index finger to her sister's philtrum. A faint breath tickles her finger, warm and regular. Younghye's lips twitch minutely.